From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. Bob Garfield is away this week. I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, the House voted to deny the federally funded group Acorn any more money. Acorn staffers have been fired, and the group, which provides assistance to low-income families, is now conducting its own internal investigation, all prompted by a sting conducted by two young activists, James O'Keefe, playing a pimp, and Hannah Giles, posing as a prostitute, who taped Acorn workers offering advice on how to cheat the system in five different cities. Their incriminating videos were posted on the conservative website biggovernment.com.
Let me make sure there's a code for it, okay?
A code for prostitution?
Okay, let's see what we got here. Performance art, independent artists. You can be that.
The Daily Show's Jon Stewart had harsh words for the mainstream media.
You're telling me that two kids from the cast of High School Musical 3 can break this story with a video camera and their grandmother's chinchilla coat, and you got nothing?
So what is the role of the mainstream media here? They didn't break the story, but they could contextualize it, describe Acorn, its function, and yes, even its role as a political lightning rod since the election. But mostly what we get is the tape, which definitely is news. But it's news generated for a political purpose, and its trajectory into the mainstream media has followed a pattern that has found much success in the Obama era. To wit, an independent conservative blogger digs up or generates a piece of information, real like the Acorn story or imagined like the doubts over the president's citizenship. It gets picked up by a bigger conservative site like the Drudge Report or WorldNet Daily and jumps from there to Fox News, which covers it relentlessly while tweaking other news outlets until they pick it up. Here's Fox News' Glenn Beck.
Fox has had 133 reports on it. CNN, 90. MSNBC, 10. How's that possible? Hey, ABC, how's it working out for you with two?
From the birthers to the Tea Partiers to town hall disruptions to past actions by former Green Czar Van Jones to past remarks of Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor, stories of varying import and validity are lofted into the headlines pretty much the same way, ripped from the blogs. In this month's Atlantic Magazine, writer Mark Bowden traces how Sotomayor's off-the-record comments were run on every TV news outlet without much, if any, context. He explains precisely what she meant, which couldn't be discerned from the snippets, and his frustration is palpable.
Frankly, Brooke, one of the things that really surprised me was that, to my knowledge, none of the major news organizations went back and actually listened to those comments in the context in which they were offered, because it doesn't take a great deal of time to see that those snippets presented out of context misrepresent her point of view.
So cast your mind back to one of the first blog-generated controversies, when Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott was at Strom Thurmond's birthday party, and he expressed regret that Thurmond hadn't won the presidency when he ran much earlier in his career as a segregationist. Is this what you would consider, in your words, news as ammunition?
I think to some extent, from my memory of Trent Lott in that instance, I think that too much was made of that comment, weighed against the balance of his public life. What I lament is when I see large news organizations basically forfeiting their journalistic role and handing the platform over to political activists. In the case of Sotomayor, or I would argue in the case of Trent Lott, fairly viewed, I don't think that you had something that was anywhere near the consequence that it was being given by being broadcast out of context repeatedly. I think the design of the political operative is to draw the largest possible inference from these specific episodes. And I think it's the role of professional journalists to put these kinds of things in perspective.
What do you make of the fact that after the Van Jones resignation, Fox's Sean Hannity declared that they were going to systematically go after and take down every one of Obama's quote-unquote czars? And their next target was Cass Sunstein, who is the administrator of the White House Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs. On Thursday, a story appeared on WorldNet Daily quoting Sunstein as saying, "It's desirable to give American wealth to poor nations."
Well, I think what you're seeing is what I'm lamenting in this essay in The Atlantic, and that is when major news organizations are replaced by people like Hannity or by websites that are advocating a particular point of view, you live in a world, sort of a ping-pong world, where facts are shot in one direction or the other, and you're, as the viewer, sitting there turning your head from left to right to left to right.
All right. Thank you very much.
Okay, Brooke. Bye-bye.
Mark Bowden is a national correspondent for The Atlantic. This week, the Senate Armed Services Committee debated whether to boost U.S. troop levels in Afghanistan. The historically daunting challenges posed by that place have led many pundits to invoke the quagmire of Vietnam. And this week, President Obama was asked about it.
Do you reflect on what happened to Lyndon Johnson and worry the same might happen to you?
Well, I think that you have to learn the lessons from history. On the other hand, each historical moment is different. You never step into the same river twice. And so Afghanistan is not Vietnam, but the dangers of overreach and not having clear goals and not having strong support from the American people, those are all issues that I think about all the time.
If he doesn't understand that we are in Vietnam now, or as I think of it, Vietnamistan, he's absolutely removed from reality.
One could argue that you may be seeing the world through Vietnam-colored lenses.
Absolutely. I agree. Couldn't agree more.
That's Daniel Ellsberg, legendary leaker of the Pentagon Papers, a top-secret history of failed policy and lies about America's involvement in Vietnam. A new film about the man and his leak, called The Most Dangerous Man in America, opened this week in New York and will soon across the country. The film starts with the moment almost 40 years ago when he removed the documents from his safe at the Rand Corporation, left behind his clearances, his colleagues, his career as a Pentagon insider, and risked prison to put the papers before the public. It culminated in a stunning 1971 Supreme Court decision in favor of press freedom. Ellsberg's main regret is that he waited years to do what he did, a mistake he hopes isn't repeated.
I'm sure there are many people in the Pentagon and CIA and the White House who are in my shoes right now. And my advice to them is, don't do what I did. Don't reveal it 6 years from now. Don't wait till the escalation has occurred. Instead, they should do what I wish I had done in 1965, and that is tell the public what I believed right then, that my president was making a terrible mistake and that Congress should hold hearings, Congress should demand the truth, and Congress should set him straight. Just in the last 2 weeks, we have now learned that many Democrats are standing up and questioning their Democratic president. Where are they to get their information from? Purely from the cabinet ministers who are doing the president's bidding?
What is this material that you think ought to be leaked to the public?
When you say out there, should we say in there? What's in the safes? What's inside the Pentagon? What's in the White House? I am sure there are estimates in the State Department Intelligence, INR, which was right about Iraq, right about Vietnam. I'll bet they're right about now. And what Congress should be hearing from them, if they were leaked, is that putting more troops in will strengthen our enemy, that putting those troops in, supporting them with drones, killing civilians, however many activists we may kill also, replaces those activists overnight, multiplies them, as it did in Vietnam. Vice President Biden and General James Jones, the National Security Assistant, have doubts. That's interesting. That gives us an opening here. But what are their doubts? What are the pieces of paper that have convinced them that have come over their desk? What are the estimates they're getting? Congress needs those, and the press needs those, the public needs those.
So you don't anticipate that this government will supply the Congress with the kind of accurate information it would need to openly debate this
issue? They've had 8 months to do it, and they haven't done it yet, and I don't expect them to do it.
You're sure this information is there? Do you have any proof?
Am I sitting here with the documents from the administration? Certainly not. I haven't had access to those for a long time, except when they come out years later, as in Iraq. I've got lots of documents now, in books by Richard Clark, in books by many others, of the information that was withheld from us by them and others for years. So I can look at the situation, and frankly, it's my degree of identity with the people in those jobs. I acted in that for a dozen years. I've followed it very closely since. I follow the leaks that are going on.
So what is the role of the leaker in this environment?
There are a lot of people looking at estimates that are being withheld from the public, at plans for the next 50,000, the next 87,000 troops that are going in that the public is not going to be told about until after they're there. And I think they should ask themselves, did my oath to uphold and support the Constitution really permit me to keep quiet when I see the public being lied to? Now, I would hope that some of them, when they consider that, will consider taking a very great personal risk, even to their families when it comes to income, to their status in society, possibly a risk of prosecution, and telling Congress information that they believe Congress ought to have in making these decisions and the public ought to have, and they might save hundreds of thousands of lives.
So what happens if this material that you believe exists inside of government gets out, is leaked, goes before the Congress, and nothing happens?
That's the question. What do we do about it? What do you do about it? What do I do about it? And what does Congress do about it? The lesson that I learned, I think, from the Pentagon Papers, from reading them, which set me to be an activist, it changed my life, was telling the truth has no guarantee that it will make for better policy, but it's a better gamble than leaving it up to the president to make these decisions on his or her own.
Dan, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Daniel Ellsberg. The new documentary about him is called The Most Dangerous Man in America, partly because he managed to defeat the most powerful one, Richard Nixon.
I wanted to tell you that I was so damn mad when that Supreme Court had to come down. I didn't like their decision, but
I didn't either.
Unbelievable, wasn't it?
It was unbelievable.
You know, those clowns we've got on there, I'll tell you, I hope I outlive the bastards.
Up next, whether you're an exhibitionist or excruciatingly shy, the internet can make you worse. This is On the Media from NPR.
Hey, pod people, this is Katya, senior producer of OTM. Finally, for the first time ever, you can get an On the Media t-shirt, a notebook, a refrigerator magnet, a mouse pad, whatever. We got it. If you want it, you can find it by clicking the link on our website, onthemedia.org.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. In November of 2008, the Chinese Health Ministry recognized internet addiction as a medical diagnosis. That country, one of the first to establish treatment centers for the disorder, now has hundreds of clinics set up to help people get offline. Here in the States, we're more skeptical of the diagnosis, but now we do have one treatment program, Restart, which calls itself an internet addiction recovery program. Hillary Cash is the executive director of Restart. Welcome to the show.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
So define internet addiction. Is it a clinical term?
It's not an official clinical term yet. We do know that in the next version of the DSM, they are going to have a category for non-substance use addictions. And we know that gambling is going to be there. What other behavioral addictions make their way into that is entirely dependent on the weight of evidence. But all behavioral addictions have certain things in common with substance addictions: loss of control or compulsivity about engaging in it, the development of tolerance, the experience of withdrawal, and the engagement in it in spite of negative consequences.
Now, you already have your first patient who right now is undergoing treatment at the facility. Can you tell me about Ben Alexander?
Ben, I think in many ways, is going to be a typical client. He's 19. He has social anxiety. He found that going online to socialize was where he preferred to be rather than sort of out in the world and dating and hanging out with friends. It didn't matter too much while he was still under the structure of his family, but once he went off to college, he really just fell right down that rabbit hole into an addictive pattern where he barely went to classes and slowly over time began to fail out.
Can you tell me what Ben's treatment has been like? I mean, I understand that when you're dealing with alcoholics or people who suffer from a gambling addiction, the tendency would be to go cold turkey. Can you prescribe cold turkey to your clients?
We do prescribe cold turkey. This really is an opportunity for them to spend 45 days free of the internet. It gives their brains a chance to kind of detox and begin to rewire into more normal patterns. So he'll get up in the morning, have breakfast. He'll be involved then in house chores, cleaning up, gardening, care of animals, that kind of thing. After that, there's physical exercise. Many of the activities in the afternoon are centered around vocational therapy. They're working right now on developing his carpentry skills. And then in the evening, there's mindfulness training, 12-step work, and other addiction-related work.
Now, I know Ben is your first client, but if he is, as you say, typical of who you expect to come into your program, aren't his problems really separate from the internet? I mean, if you were to, say, treat him for his social anxiety disorder and whatever other problems that he takes with him to the internet, then he wouldn't need to be cured of an internet addiction. Isn't that much more of a symptom than it is a cause?
What people often don't understand is that addiction becomes its own problem. You do indeed need to address those root problems, but actually it becomes very difficult to address them effectively as long as the addiction is active.
Hillary Cash is Executive Director of Restart, an internet addiction recovery program in Washington State. Ben Alexander has just completed the 45-day treatment, and he joins me now. Ben, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Tell me about your drug of choice, World of Warcraft.
Well, it's a massively multiplayer online role-playing game, which basically means that you play with people from all around the world, and you have this kind of character that you create that represents you in the world.
What about it did you find so addictive?
Well, part of it was the social aspect. It's a very social game, a lot of working together with other people to complete objectives and things like that. I've always dealt with a lot of social anxiety, and it was just a lot easier to be comfortable socializing online than it ever was in real life for me.
You didn't feel like the kind of ease that you had in the game could translate to the real world?
Not at the time, no. I've been doing a lot more getting out and meeting people in real life, and it's been easier than I thought it would be.
Can you describe what the moment was, if there was a moment, when you realized that you really had a problem?
Yeah, it was about halfway through my first semester in college, and I realized that if I kept doing what I was doing, which was pretty much play World of Warcraft all day, every day, I was going to flunk out of college.
But you couldn't stop?
No, I couldn't. My dad tried to help. I went to him and asked for his help, and he tried to help me set up rules about when I could play, and, I mean, none of it worked.
How many days since you left the center?
3 days.
3 days. And are you nervous? Are you pretty comfortable? Are you confident?
I am. Right now, my parents have it set up where I have access to their computer, and I can get online for work-related things, and also for reconnecting with friends that I kind of lost contact with.
So, Ben, good luck.
Thank you.
Ben Alexander is a former patient of Restart, the first internet addiction recovery center in the United States. Josh Harris was truly internet obsessed. It may have driven him crazy. A new film called We Live in Public dubs him the greatest internet pioneer you've never heard of. But people, in fact, did know his name in the 80s, as he noted, when he made millions launching and selling an internet company.
When the press called around, I was the smartest guy in town, and the reporters knew it.
I was a regular on CNN, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, USA Today, the Los Angeles Times, international press, et cetera, et cetera.
His first company was followed by a series of projects that could be seen either as failed business ventures or landmark social experiments. Among them, An anything-goes internet TV station, a community living in a bunker where its members' every scuffle or shower or sexual act was captured on cameras, and the first personal life cam. Andy Timoner, the director of We Live in Public, says Harris made his fortune starting a company that predicted the rate at which internet usage would grow, but...
apparently, he cooked up his first reports. He just kind of made them up and showed a 45-degree rise in profits, and everybody loved it.
He made up the data, perhaps initially, and yet he proved to be right.
Yes, he had a very, very good sense of how we would react to technology, partly because he himself sought fame. He saw that instinct was in all of us. He said, you know, Andy Warhol's wrong. It's not 15 minutes of fame in a lifetime, it's 15 minutes every day. And with the internet, we'll all have the chance at that.
One thing that was really striking is that he moved from one prediction to another, to another, to another. And he always proved to be right. And yet he never made any money except off that first one.
Well, the thing is that Josh is more interested in being first than being commercial. His own company, Jupiter, predicted that broadband would not be available until the year 2000. Yet, well before, he founded Pseudo, the first internet television network, in 1994, that basically had 0.001% of the population or something, because who has the bandwidth to watch television on the internet, and who cares to watch a postage stamp image inside a little box on the screen? Not many people.
A lot of people said about Beethoven that he composed for pianos that hadn't been invented yet.
Yeah. And I was blown away by this internet television network. What is this?
We are at a very hip underground Soho party, and it's an aphrodisiac party.
You know, it was way before the internet was really in any of our consciousness as a medium that we would watch anything on. And more than anything, it was his dream to be the head of a studio. Television gave him his idea of family. He was raised on Gilligan's Island.
Just sit right back and you'll hear a tale of a fateful trip.
What role did that particular program play in the formation of Josh Harris?
Apparently, Gilligan's Island is his family. Those characters, they were the only people he could rely on, that they would be on at a certain time every day, and he could count on that show to nurture him. And so he has an alter ego that starts to show up while he's running Pseudo Communications. And literally, he's showing up at board meetings as Lovey, sort of a scary, white-faced clown, which is based on the character Lovey Howell.
Yeah, she's a middle-aged, ditzy millionaire-ess in the show. And she takes on something of a sinister aspect when embodied by Josh Harris. His colleagues at work thought he was going crazy, and he was actually turning off his investors.
Yes, he was asked to step away from Pseudo, and that was fine with him. He was ready to build the bunker at that point. But really, I think Lovey Howell on Gilligan's Island, I think he identified as his mother. All of the anger and antipathy that he had towards his mother was embodied in this scary clown.
You quietly dropped in there about the bunker. Let's talk about that. Harris still had millions from selling his company in the 80s, and so he launched a project he called Quiet.
It was anything but quiet. It was six floors of total chaos. There was an 80-foot-long dining room table where nightly performances occurred. There was free-flowing liquor, three meals a day, communal shower in the shape of a geodesic dome right there in the middle of a pod hotel that was full of capsules that slept over 100 people. Everyone had their own surveillance camera and television monitor, and they were required to wear uniforms when they checked in and answer about 500 questions. There was a firing range with automatic weapons of every kind you could imagine.
He said this was a kind of artist project. But what do you think his real purpose was?
Well, he said that he was walking down the street one day and realized that the millennium was coming in New York City and no one was going to do anything, and that it was up to him to do something to mark this moment of transition where the virtual world is taking over. But it literally took me 8 years to figure out that what it was actually a big warning shot and a metaphor for where we could be heading with our lives online today if we're not already there.
We watch the evolution of the bunker experience in your film, and it starts out as a kind of Woodstockian liberation. And it ends up dark and ugly.
There was definitely a neo-fascistic edge to the entire event. There were interrogations that occurred, and you had to participate in those interrogations or you weren't considered to be contributing to the community.
Were you ever politically active?
Yes.
Where was that?
Here in New York, I was a member of the Communist Party.
Everyone who moved in there felt like it was going to be a fun party, like you said, but nobody could really handle the stress.
Shut up, I'm talking!
And I don't control anybody like other people try to control.
And the neo-fascistic elements, to me, were Josh Harris's attempts to say, no matter what I do, no matter how extreme the circumstances, you'll give up everything. You'll give up your privacy, and eventually you'll give up your freedom for connection and recognition.
There's a line that comes up in the quiet experiment. In fact, it's the only line you repeat in the film.
Everything is free except the video that we capture of you. That we own.
Ultimately, that's an important element of the metaphor. Everything that was done there was recorded. It was not theirs to make private again. And in fact, Josh Harris can take it and do what he wants with it. That is something that is happening every day online. And when we accept terms and conditions, it's pretty much the same thing as filling out Josh Harris's questionnaire and signing away your rights.
If you wanted to be involved, you had to be interrogated. And then you get issued a uniform.
Once you're in, you're not allowed to go out. Literally, you cannot leave the premises again.
He was very much the puppet master, and I was not happy documenting it. I actually walked away from the project after cutting a feature-length version of The Bunker in 2001. I only came back to it years later after the next step in his story occurred where he became the rat.
In the project that he called We Live in Public.
Yes. Basically, Josh decided to announce that he and his girlfriend would be the first couple ever to live in public, and that they would live for 6 months under constant surveillance. He installed 32 motion-controlled surveillance cameras in every corner of his house, from the kitty litter pan to the toilet.
Actually, in the toilet bowl.
In the bowl, and more importantly, over the bed. So his girlfriend, Tanya, was definitely an internet kid herself, excited about the medium, excited to pioneer along with him. But she just didn't feel like making love with him in public, because once the chatters were chatting and there was a live chat stream going, Tanya lost her keys once. And
I'm trying to leave the house to get out of here, but I can't find my wallet. That little silver cigarette case. Has anyone seen it? Do you know where it is?
And somebody said, oh, yeah, you left him over there, you know, over the computer. So this was kind of fun. And then it became any argument they had, chatters took sides. They ran to their computer monitors to see who won the fight. It was impossible to have an intimate relationship in public.
Josh, what? Don't do this. No. You're scaring me. Stop it. Leave me alone. Don't let go of me. Don't hurt me.
What started as a dream to conceive a baby in public ended with Tanya leaving Josh, the stock market crashing. He finds out he has a negative checking balance on his toilet, on camera.
I need to tell you, you got a negative balance in your checking account.
Okay, bye.
And he really lost his mind at that point.
It's all part of our subconscious. Yes, it's all going to come out sooner or later. It's all got to come out sooner or later. It's all got to come out sooner or later. It's all got to come out.
I guess the question for me is, was Josh Harris really trying to enact his vision of what the future may be, since he had the money and the insight to do it? Or was he just doing what any superannuated teenage boy would do if he were a millionaire in his late 30s and early 40s?
I don't think that just any teenager would do this, but I think Josh Harris would say that the next evolution of programming is welivinpublic.com, but on a massive scale, so that many, many people will be self-surveillancing.
Is it fair to say that living in public did this to him and that it could happen to us all? Or is this really just about Josh?
If this film was still just about Josh, I would not have finished it. I was absolutely struck with a lightning flash in late 2007 when I saw the first status update on Facebook. the first one that I saw, and it said, "I'm driving west on the freeway," posted 2 hours ago. And I thought, who cares? And then all of a sudden, all these people cared, and then everyone was posting what they ate for breakfast. And then, you know, I just saw this snowballing, and I thought, oh my gosh, wait a second, the bunker is a warning shot of where we are ending up, where it's almost like it doesn't exist unless it's somehow shared. And for this next generation coming up, they don't know a life before online. And as wonderful and beautiful and powerful as this invention is, there's a dark side. And I happened to record that. And it became my responsibility, I felt, to make this movie right now, because I think it's about all of us at this crucial time.
Which brings us to the final chapter of Josh Harris's life so far in your film. Harris ultimately goes off the grid, first at an apple farm, then after another failed attempt to start a business in Ethiopia. Is that the answer for all of us in our increasingly online living in public lives, that in order to seize control, we have to unplug?
Josh Harris shows us two very important things. One is, don't raise your children on technology alone. And two, don't make your life too public. Keep some part for yourself. Keep your intimate relationships private if you can. And maybe by balancing our lives, we can enjoy all the beauty that the internet brings us and not lose ourselves in the process.
Andy, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you very much for your time.
Andy Timoner is the director of We Live in Public, which opens this week in Los Angeles. Up next, is gender neutrality a Bible buster? And why dictionaries ain't what they used to be? This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. The John Dee and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Translating any beloved text is a dangerous enterprise. Language is laden with cultural and historical resonances, and the meanings of words change over time. Now, consider the task of translating and updating the Bible. The new international version of the Bible, or the NIV, released in 1984, became the most popular Bible in the world. In 2005, a group of scholars called the Committee on Bible Translation released an update to 1984's NIV called Today's New International Version, or TNIV. It caused an uproar, mostly due to its neutral take on gender. For example, here's the 1984 NIV.
Then God said, "Let us make man in our image, in our likeness."
And 2005's TNIV.
Then God said, "Let us make human beings in our image, in our likeness."
The new version included many changes, but the most vocal critics charged that the Committee on Bible Translation was yielding to a feminist agenda. The TNIV was drowned in the controversy, and this month the committee announced that it's scrapping it and starting over. Committee Chairman Doug Moo says that response to the TNIV ranged from the reasonable to the not so much.
One very irate person who perhaps was a bit mentally unbalanced even sent an NIV Bible with a rifle, having shot a bullet through it.
Do you think that people were outraged partly because they think it's a slippery slope? You know, you slip in one cultural change like gender neutrality, and it's just a matter of time before you take on homosexuality. Then you have a Bible originalist's plague of frogs or something like that.
Yes, I think that was part of the concern, that we were making some of the gender decisions out of ideology, and who knows where that would lead. Whereas our purpose all along was simply to do the best job we could to represent God's unchanging word in contemporary English.
Was there something underneath the objection of changing the word man to human beings, something in particular that you think people were nervous about?
The criticisms came on two grounds. One was that kind of change would remove what some think is a deliberate purpose on God's part to sort of highlight men as representative human beings, to single them out as those who are given attention in Scripture. And so our decision to move away from that kind of language was felt by some to be losing a theological point in the Bible. The other problem which we face in English, as many are aware, is that we have no third singular generic pronoun. When we want to refer to a single human being, it used to be we used he and him and his to do that. Many people feel that that now carries a masculine coding that the originals don't intend. But what do we replace it with? We decided to use plurals. So instead of a he, we might use a they. And we were criticized for doing that because, you know, what was a singular form in the original text now became a plural in English.
Your point, as you say, is not to push any kind of political ideology, but to reflect the language as it is currently used, right?
That's correct. And in 1984, you know, I think there was still a sense that, well, if you're translating the Bible, you can't use ordinary English because that might be offensive. Now there's a sense that, no, the Bible is written in the ordinary, everyday language of its day, and we should reflect that in using ordinary, everyday English.
You've also had to deal with Hollywood and the drug culture. The word alien appears in the 1984 version.
In many passages in the Old Testament, we've changed alien to foreigner. With the popularity of E.T. and other science fiction movies of that sort, I suspect most contemporary English listeners, when they hear the word alien, think of an extraterrestrial. And that's not, of course, what the Bible is communicating at all at that point.
I love how you attempt to cope with marijuana culture. Here's the 1984 version of 2 Corinthians 11:25.
Three times I was beaten with rods. Once I was stoned.
We could just hear the giggles from the junior high kids in the back of the church, you know, and that's read out loud.
Here's your version.
Three times I was beaten with rods. Once I was pelted with stones.
The thing that caused the dust-up back in 2005, changing man to human beings, is it staying in the 2011 version?
We are making no promises or predictions about where that's going to come out.
So you might go back.
I suspect that at some places we may go back. Other places I suspect we won't. But again, that's very hard to predict at this point.
How many of your readers do you think believe that the Bible is literally the Word of God?
It's hard to guess. The New International Version is certainly not confined to the evangelical Christian community. Again, it's the best-selling English Bible in the world right now, I think. So it is used quite broadly. But a lot of our readers do pick up the English Bible and think that here in the NIV or the TNIV, they have God's actual words for them. And that, of course, gives to our work a sense of tremendous accountability and responsibility.
So as a believer as well as a scholar, does it feel weird to be changing the words you grew up with?
Yes, it does, very, very often. And that's one of the things sometimes we have to fight against. And sometimes it can be hard to change a treasured passage that we have learned in a certain way. But again, our concern is to get it right, and we don't want to simply listen to tradition on the one hand or to the latest fad on the other. We want to represent what really is there in those ancient texts in contemporary English.
Doug, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Doug Moo is the chairman of the Committee on Bible Translation and the Blanchard Professor of New Testament at Wheaton College. September 18th is the tercentenary, the 300th birthday, that is, of Samuel Johnson, whose Dictionary of the English Language set the standard and the format for centuries of dictionaries. His format, with headwords, etymologies, sample sentences, remains unchallenged. But his standard, what dictionaries stand for, has been undergoing a slow but inexorable evolution, as OTM's own Mike Volo reports.
In 1754, the Earl of Chesterfield anxiously wrote that English was in a state of anarchy.
And all of a sudden, that anxiety just dissipates.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist at the University of California at Berkeley.
Johnson has showed that all of the flux of the language can be reduced to rule and put within the covers of a book. And the English language is settled forever. Now, of course, the English language was not settled forever.
Enter Noah Webster, born in a British colony called Connecticut, just a few years after Johnson's dictionary was published. In 1789, the year America held its first presidential election, Webster wrote, "Our honor requires us to have a system of our own, in language as well as government." Jeff Nunberg.
We've broken away in politics, we're breaking away in culture. Why should we speak the same language? And Jefferson and Adams and Webster were only some of the figures at the time who thought, no, we would speak American or federal.
Published in the late 1820s, Webster's dictionary introduced thousands of new American words, plus new American definitions of words. And it changed the way we spell O-R instead of O-U-R, E-R instead of R-E.
Webster's dictionary was very much an attempt to replace Johnson's dictionary, at least in the American context, with a dictionary that would reflect the values of this new democratic society that had emerged on the other side of the Atlantic.
Fittingly, Webster called his book an American Dictionary of the English Language. Its only true descendants today are the Merriam-Webster dictionaries, the Merriams being two brothers who got the publishing rights after Webster died. The company's 1934 landmark New International Dictionary, second edition, was £17 with more than 600,000 entries. It was and is the largest single-volume dictionary of English and was deemed not only authoritative, but the authority, period.
That dictionary seemed to crystallize the language of public discourse as it should be.
So how do you follow an act like Webster's second? With Webster's third, published 27 years later, edited by the scholarly and degree-laden Philip Gove, who, unlike his predecessors, was a linguistic egalitarian. National Endowment for the Humanities editor David Skinner, who was working on a book about the third, says that even pronunciations are created equal under Gove. Take, for example, err, E-R-R.
If you look up the word in Webster's third, you get at least five pronunciations. They are air, air, like the air we breathe. Er, the very old-fashioned one. Air, which I don't recall hearing myself. And the more British, air, without even an R. So if you want to know how to say this word, E-R-R, you're in for some very hard work when you open Webster's third. Another example, this one with regard to spelling, is the term memento. Memento is spelled M-E-M-E-N-T-O. But some people misspell it. They write M-O-M-E-N-T-O, like moment-o. The editors of Webster's Third included this as a legitimate variant, but I think most people would tell you that's just a misspelling.
It's just wrong.
It's just wrong.
In his zeal to describe words as people use them, Gove sometimes veered off into the insulting. One of his definitions for the word Jew, for example, is, quote, a person believed to drive a hard bargain. In his zeal to define words for a popular audience, Gove sometimes veered off into the absurd. Take the definition for the word door. I asked some people on the street to define it for me.
The point in space that represents the threshold between two separate areas.
Part of a wall that moves, allowing you access to the other side of the wall.
Something that keeps people out.
Oh, goodness. How much time do you have?
In the New York Public Library, Assistant Director of Reference Services, Matthew Sheehy, thumbed through Webster's third in the main reading room, looking for door.
It's a big book. A movable piece of firm material or a structure supported, usually along one side, and swinging on pivots or hinges, sliding along a groove, rolling up or down, revolving as one of four leaves, or folding like an accordion, by means of which an opening may be closed or kept open for passage into or out of a building, room, or other covered enclosure, or a car, airplane, elevator, or other vehicle. And that's just the first definition of the word. It goes on.
Who exactly is that definition for?
I would say that definition's for a Martian. I mean, someone who's never seen a door ever and has no concept of what a door is. The best thing about it, of course, is there's an illustration next to it in case you need it to visualize what a door is.
On the other hand, Gove sometimes gave too little information. He did away with many judgmental labels like improper, erroneous, and colloquial. And he withheld judgment in other ways, too. David Skinner.
Webster's third offered a more complete set of curse words. It introduced, for instance, and Webster's second gave a very literal definition for homosexual attracted to someone of the same sex. If you look it up in Webster's third, it says homosexual is a normal stage in male adolescent development. That's a very different kind of dictionary.
But it was a very different four-letter word that caused perhaps the loudest outcry. The linguist Jeffrey Nunberg.
Where Gove went off the rails, as far as his critics were concerned, was in failing to condemn words like ain't. And in that sense, the dictionary represented, in the views of many of its critics, an assault on all that was important about culture. Those patient and dedicated saboteurs in Springfield, Massachusetts, as Wilson Follett described the editors of Webster's Third. It was a huge brouhaha.
In 1961, when Webster's Third was published, Philip Gove was the lexicographical antichrist.
There were cartoons in The New Yorker, a man coming into the reception area of Merriam-Webster and the receptionist saying, "Mr. Gove ain't in." Nero Wolfe, in one of the Nero Wolfe detective stories, tearing apart a copy of Webster's Third and feeding the pages to the flames in his fireplace saying, "Contact is not a verb in this house."
The Washington Post printed an editorial under the headline, "Keep Your Old Websters." The New York Times Book Review called the third a gigantic flop. The Detroit Free Press said it was cheap and corrupt. Quote, "It is not a dictionary as Samuel Johnson or Noah Webster conceived of one. It is a catalog."
The business of a dictionary is to really do two things. It's to describe usage. It's to say, for example, the adverb literally has been used since the early 19th century, at least in a sense that means figuratively. Thackeray wrote, "I literally blazed with wit." At the same time, and this is something else dictionaries have to say, there are people who are driven up a wall by this.
Anybody who expects language to be logical should go back and think again.
Aaron McKean is former editor of the New Oxford American Dictionary.
The words that we have grown up organically. They are not concrete blocks. They're river stones.
To the persnickety language police types, McKean calls them peevologists, one big, jagged river stone of a word is irregardless.
I would defy any peevologist to show me an example where someone got completely the wrong idea from the use of the word irregardless. Now, that said, do I think everybody should go out and use the word irregardless? And I say no, because it's what's called a skunked term, where there are so many people who are upset about this word that we have to kind of leave it alone until the smell wears off.
Smelly or not, it's in Philip Gove's Webster's Third, and it is certainly in Aaron McKean's own online dictionary, Wordnik. For any given entry, Wordnik contains recent examples from print and the internet, and real-time examples from a Twitter feed. It compiles statistics like frequency of use dating back to 1800 and provides a place for users to leave notes that may be helpful to others. McKean calls Wordnik the ultimate descriptive dictionary. She wants to document all words that are used, however fleeting, however novel, however made up.
Yesterday I was talking with some of the people I work with, and I said, well, that makes the problem much more breakdownable. And they looked up at me and they said, "Breakdownable?" I said, "You understood it, didn't you?" And we went and looked it up, and, you know, we didn't really have any data for it. But it existed. I mean, the minute I said it, they understood me. And we should record all of that.
Should we? Really? I remembered a sentence I read last year in the Wall Street Journal online, September 17th, 2008, by financial journalist David Gaffin.
For all of the consternation surrounding the craptacular performance of the financials, it is worth noting...
Wait a minute. Let's hear that again.
Surrounding the craptacular performance of the financials.
Maybe, like me, you were confused by craptacular. I called David Gaffin, who now works for Reuters.
I think it is meant to meld together the words crap and spectacular. So it is an amazingly terrific train wreck of a performance of something. And that's kind of what was going on with the financial stocks at the time. They were spectacularly awful.
It's in Wordnik. It's in the Wall Street Journal, albeit online. How about Webster's? I called Peter Sokolovsky, Merriam-Webster's editor-at-large, and asked him to define craptacular.
You need to use it in a sentence, just like a spelling bee, because context is everything. But we have our open source dictionaries free online, and I bet it's there. And I bet it has some kind of a nickel definition.
Okay, let me check that out.
Craptacular.
Craptacular.
There it is.
spectacular crap, something that is rendered shocking or fascinating by its low quality or poor condition. The rotten old abandoned amusement park was a craptacular place to spend the afternoon.
Now that's a useful entry.
So it was in Merriam-Webster after all, written not by a lexicographer but by a citizen wordsmith in its online open source dictionary. As for the unabridged Webster's Third, well, it's been nearly 50 years since Philip Gove was headline news, and now his dictionary is the authority, perched on a lectern outside the reading room at the Library of Congress. Although a fourth edition is reportedly in the works. And when it does come out, some guardians of the English language will declare it the death of standards and the ruination of all that was holy in our language. And the rest of us will shake our heads and say, ain't that just craptacular? For On the Media, I'm Mike Buolo.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Buolo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Michael Bernstein, and PJ Vogt, with more help from James Hover and Dan Mazzi, and edited by me. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh. Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. Bob Garfield will be back next week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.